Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We are still warm here in the valley, but not quite as hot as yesterday. We're looking for a potential high of 82 degrees today. It's currently partly cloudy and 79. Quickly in valley traffic, collisions on I-10 westbound at 43rd Avenue and the 101 westbound at Tatum.
Earlier this month, crews began the process of removing the water from Tempe Town Lake. It's a slow process, but as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, there's a good reason for that.
Less than half of the lake has already been drained. That translates to about a half a foot of water each day. Chris Baxter-Ging is with the city of Tempe. She says a slow drain was planned. The city wanted to reuse the water, so they worked with SRP to move the water into the canal system. But
their canal has a capacity. We can't surpass that capacity. So because we want to conserve that water and use it, we are working under mathematical restrictions.
Baxter-Ging says the water will be used to irrigate lawns, parks, and gardens. Once the lake is completely drained, crews will be able to start work on the new dam. The city is already warning people to avoid the area during that time. It's a no trespassing zone and violators will be ticketed. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The endangered Mexican gray wolf population in Arizona and New Mexico is down. At the end of 2015, state and federal field teams reported there were roughly 97 Mexican gray wolves living in the wild. That's down from 110 at the end of 2014. Jim DeVos is the Assistant Director for Wildlife Management at the Arizona Game and Fish Department.
Although we've experienced some mortality, both at the pups and adults, we still have 97 on the ground. And with that 97, overall, we're still on a positive trajectory for Mexican wolf recovery.
DeVos says the decline is the result of a higher adult mortality rate and lower pup survival rate. He adds it's hard to know for sure if this was an anomaly or just normal annual variation.
Yesterday's high temperature was 90 degrees, setting the record for the day. Yesterday's average high temperature was 71. Today, instead of feeling like mid-April, it'll only feel like, you know, maybe mid-March. Joining me to talk about why it's been so hot is meteorologist Chris Kuhlman with the National Weather Service in Phoenix. And Chris, did forecasters see all these new record high temps coming?
Not to the degree that actually occurred. We saw at least a week out that it would definitely be a good warming trend, and an 80s was definitely possible 7-8 days out, lower 80s, but you know, it didn't really become clear until probably 5 days out that we'd be hitting near records and or possibly even exceeding those records.
Is this a typical part of an El Nino pattern?
That's hard to say, actually, but when you can definitely have these sorts of high-pressure patterns that set up late in the wintertime or even during any time in the spring, and it was a persistent pattern, and when it resides over our area that long, it's definitely possible to have record temperatures or near that, and it was a very strong high-pressure ridge and lasted for on the order of a good week and a half.
We've been hearing for a while that forecasters were saying that this El Nino would bring some moisture and some rain to the Phoenix area. Is that still the case? Are we still expecting some rain before summer comes?
It's not a definite, that's for sure. I mean, the El Nino is weakening currently, but the pattern itself is still there. Just have to wait and see how the weather pattern over the Pacific evolves over the next month or so and whether or not it will send any storm systems up our way. In the next month, we'll have to wait and see. It's possible, but it's definitely not a definite. As we get further into March, the chances are getting less and less. The winter systems tend to happen during the month of January and February. So right now, February doesn't look like we're going to have anything at all. At least through the next 10 days, it looks to be dry.
Should we all be concerned for this summer, given that it was 90 degrees already in February? Like, does that just mean June, July, August are going to be worse than normal?
No. Just because we're getting these record temperatures now doesn't mean that we'll have record temperatures during the summertime. So there's no correlation that we can really draw from that.
Chris Kuhlman is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Phoenix.
The Phoenix Suns have been struggling this season, potentially on pace for the second worst record in team history. And for some fans, today was to be a day of hope. Just about an hour ago, we reached the NBA's trading deadline, the last chance before the end of the season to get better players, or at least new players. The Suns didn't do much, but they did find a taker for the most controversial player, forward Markieff Morris. To tell us more, I'm joined by Dave King, who is managing editor of the Suns-focused blog, Bright Side of the Sun. So, Dave, a lot of Suns fans are rejoicing right now because the most controversial Suns player, Markieff Morris, is gone. Where did he go, and what did the Suns get for him?
Markieff Morris was traded to the Washington Wizards, who are underperforming a little bit this year. They had expected to be playoff bound, but they're a little under 500.
And so the Suns got what for him? I know they got a draft pick and a couple of players, right?
Yeah, they actually got what's reported to be a top 9 protected draft pick. Right now, the Wizards, if they finish with the same winning percentage they have today, so if you're not a believer in Markieff Morris making you a winner, then you should be happy about this. The pick is protected only top 9 in the draft next year, and the Wizards are slotted around 12, and where the Suns are currently slotted in the top 3 or 4, and so the Suns could have 2 lottery picks out of this. And then they also picked up a couple of players who will most likely just finish out the season and then get waived in the summer.
So for people who don't follow the Suns, Dave, quite that closely, why is Markieff Morris so controversial? It's a pretty long list of things, right?
Certainly last year is when he started boiling over after he and his brother signed their contract extensions. I think they got the impression that they could do no wrong. And really, they started arguing with refs and getting technical fouls. And then Markieff famously, after the Suns scored an abysmal 24 points in the first half against the Spurs and were not even competitive the whole game, he actually blamed the fans for not getting the team into the game, excited for the game.
And Dave, finally, considering how bad a season this has been, in part because of injuries, but a lot of other things as well, were you surprised the Suns didn't trade more players today?
I actually was, but you know what? I think at this point, the most important thing was getting Morris out of there. And if he took up all their time this week and it just worked out that that's all they had time to do, I'm fine with that.
Dave King is managing editor of the Suns-focused blog, Bright Side of the Sun. We've been talking about what the Suns did today on the NBA's trading deadline. Dave, thank you.
Thank you.
A state House committee yesterday approved a bill that would eliminate licensing requirements for several professions, including geologists, assayers, and landscape architects. Renee Guillen, policy advisor for the governor's office, told the House Commerce Committee House Bill 2613 is a good idea.
Simply stated, licensing should be the last option, not the first. We should be willing to periodically review the status quo and see if current regulations reach the proper balance of employment opportunity and government oversight. Reducing regulations means more money for hardworking Arizonans.
But Guillen said the current language is not set in stone and that the governor's office is open to potential changes before it's approved by the full legislature. That, however, is not enough to address the concerns of Chris Jones. He's a licensed landscape architect with the firm Anderson Barron and is opposed to House Bill 2613. Chris, what does one have to do to become a licensed landscape architect?
Well, to get a license to be a landscape architect, you first have to go to an accredited program. ASU and U of A both have accredited landscape architectural programs. And after that, the state of Arizona requires 3 years of experience under a licensed landscape architect within that state. At that point, you can sit for the registration exams. At that point, you pass your exams, you submit it to the Board of Technical Registration, and you receive your license, which gives you the right to stamp and seal drawings and basically giving your warranty on the competency and of your work.
So is the concern then that if you don't need to be licensed to be a landscape architect in Arizona, that people who maybe don't have the qualifications or maybe aren't honest or maybe just don't know what they're doing will be competing for jobs with you?
That is the concern. There are lots of people that are related to our industry that are involved but don't have the same educational background or the experience to be aware of the issues that arise when you're shaping the land that the public is in. There are numerous hazards that are out there that could affect the health, welfare, the life of an individual that aren't necessarily apparent to those people unless you've had the education and the training and the experience of being able to see those.
One of the questions that I heard asked a couple of times at the committee hearing was, are people hiring you because of your skills and because they have seen your work and they know what you're capable of doing and they like the kind of work that you do, or are they hiring you because you have a license and you have a stamp on your plans?
All things being equal, two designers, same level of experience, same education. One individual has a license, the other does not. The one with the license will get the work because they're carrying on that liability. And our big concern is that our clients will require still that license, and they'll just get it from a registered landscape architect from another state.
If this bill is approved by the legislature and goes into law, what will be the impact on your industry?
It's hard to say with any definitive answer what the ramifications are. We have lots of fears, and fears that we believe are quite founded. Our number one fear is that this is just going to kill jobs in our industry here in the Valley. Right now we have two schools, universities that have accredited programs. Those programs are going to suffer if a student goes there to get their accredited degree but can't work in the same state to achieve their licensure in order to practice. Right now, as a licensed landscape architect, I can apply for reciprocity in another state to obtain license, the ability to stamp drawings in that other state. But I have to be licensed and in good standing in the state that I reside in.
Do you think landscape architects will leave Arizona if there's no license requirement?
I truly do believe that. I believe there's going to be a mass drain of the talent that we have. Another fear that we have is for those of us who do stay in the state, I mean, those of us who are here, our biggest concern is also going to be the loss of revenue through other licensed professionals in other states coming into the state to perform our task, because they'll be carrying the liability for our client.
Chris Jones is a licensed landscape architect with the firm Anderson Barron and is opposed to House Bill 2613, which would eliminate licensing requirements for professions including his. By the way, we did reach out to the sponsor of the bill, Representative Warren Peterson. Through a spokeswoman, he declined our request for an interview.
For many people, getting a traffic citation amounts to nothing more than just an extra expense. But for many others, that cost can overwhelm an already tight budget. The consequences of an unpaid fine can be even more fees, a suspended license, and in some cases, even jail time. But as KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, a new policy in the Phoenix court system could help residents avoid racking up excessive penalties.
Now serving B1.
The customer service area in the Phoenix Municipal Court is a busy place. Among the roughly 30 people in the waiting room today is Joshua Cara. He's here to start paying the $2,200 he owes the city for various traffic violations, a bill he says he isn't sure he can pay off right away.
It's a lot of money to just fork out right now.
Right now, his license is suspended, in part because he hadn't paid off some of those fines. And not having a valid license, he adds, is a frustrating experience.
It's horrible. I mean, a lot of jobs you can't get because you don't have a license. I mean, in Phoenix, it's a big place. Everything's spread out, so it's hard not without transportation. You can't rely on the bus system.
But Cara is hoping that will change today. He came in to see if he qualifies for a new city program for people whose licenses have been suspended for failing to pay traffic citation fines. The new policy allows residents to get their licenses back as soon as they begin making monthly payments. In the past, the city required people to pay their balances in full before reinstating a license. Don Taylor is the chief presiding judge at the Phoenix Municipal Court.
We're not forgiving the amounts that they were found to be responsible for. They are still paying those amounts. We're simply putting it within their reach in a sustainable way.
Taylor played a large role in drafting this policy known officially as the Compliance Assistance Program. He says it's for people who have missed payments for fines on civil traffic violations like speeding or illegally parking, and then puts them back on a payment plan that fits within their ability to pay.
And so what we're really hoping to accomplish with this program is finding a way to help people be in compliance and sustain that compliance so that they don't suffer the collateral consequences over the long term.
Taylor says the goal is to help the city reduce its roughly $283 million fine backlog and break what can be a vicious cycle of late fees and other penalties. He explains the pattern he typically sees is someone gets a fine they can't afford to pay, so their license gets suspended, leaving them without a reliable way to get to work. Rather than risk losing their job, many drive anyway. If they get caught, that means even more fines and now a criminal charge, which can carry jail time.
We sat down and I wanted to really look at and make sure we were doing everything we can to make sure that law enforcement is about public safety and not tax collection.
Phoenix City Councilwoman Kate Gallego said lawmakers began considering this option last year as the national conversation was developing in Ferguson, Missouri, around punitive law enforcement practices.
So if you have a $100 fine at the city of Phoenix, it becomes a $252 obligation because of all the fines that other levels of government tack on.
And Gallego contends these extra fees disproportionately impact low-income residents.
There aren't a lot of wealthy people who are getting fined for driving without insurance.
Sam Brook is with the Southern Poverty Law Center. He says this policy is part of a small but growing movement among lower courts across the country that are reforming their practices so that the poor are not disproportionately impacted.
What I'm hoping is we are at the beginning of a watershed moment where this is kind of sweeping across the country and we're going to be seeing more and more reforms.
Brooke adds what's encouraging is this policy change was implemented without the threat of litigation.
I would say that in the last 2 years, we've made more progress in this forum across the country than we have in the last several decades.
The Compliance Assistance Program has been in place for about 3 weeks now. In that time, the city reports more than 1,000 people have signed up. Officials say if this program makes a measurable difference in this unpaid fine and license suspension cycle, they plan to expand the concept to other areas in the court system. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ for Thursday, February 18th. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick today, I'm Steve Goldstein. We are just 2 days out from the Democratic caucus in Nevada and the Republican primary in South Carolina. Unlike the Democrats, the GOP race is still fractured and split among several candidates. Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush. But there's a growing question among party officials whether any of them is viable.
And viable here means having enough delegates to be nominated at the party convention in Cleveland in July. If not, there's a slim chance they could end up with a contested convention where no candidate has the required 1,237 delegates to clinch the nomination.
The chairman of that convention is House Speaker Paul Ryan, and he says, don't worry about it.
I think all this talk about brokered conventions and who's up and who's down is all ridiculous. We've got plenty of qualified people running for president, and I think a good person will emerge from that field because the Republican primary voter will make sure that that happens.
Ridiculous? Maybe. Reporter fantasy? Definitely. And it was reported this week, however, that a monthly dinner among party elites, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and RNC Chairman Reince Priebus, included talk of the possibility of a contested convention. So the question is, what would a contested convention look like? Would Donald Trump be able to negotiate his way to the nomination, or would the Republican establishment try to prop up someone else? Here to help us understand some of the rules and the history behind contested conventions is Joss Putnam. He's a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He specializes in campaigns and elections. Joss Putnam, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
So, political journalist fantasy or real thing? It's unlikely, but could a contested convention happen?
Well, anything's possible, I suppose, but regardless of this, we talk about contested conventions every 4 years, just about. So, and we're talking about it again this time. What I urge folks is to realize this is a sequential process, right? That we go from Iowa to New Hampshire to South Carolina to Nevada and so on and so forth. And what that means is that we're constantly weighing who the winners and losers are. And that's a far different experience than if we were all states were voting on the same day.
So, all right, but let's look at the history very quickly. It's been decades since this has happened. For Democrats, it was 1952 when Adlai Stevenson needed 3 ballots to get the nomination. The GOP hasn't had a contested convention since 1948 when Thomas Dewey, governor of New York, took 3 ballots as well. So it has been decades, and these days political conventions are really packaged infomercials. They're not like conventions of old. What would lead to this? What would have to happen? Donald Trump continues to get 30% of the Republican vote, and the establishment candidates like Rubio and Jeb Bush just split the rest with Cruz in there as well? Is that what has to happen?
Essentially, yes. I mean, again, given that this is a sequential process, we tend to see the field of candidates winnow over time. If that doesn't happen, it raises the chances that no one gets to that 1,237 delegates that you mentioned before.
So then we're on the floor. You need 1,237. What happens? There's a vote. Nobody gets to 1,237. Then what? Take us behind the pipe and drape curtains. What do the negotiations look like?
Given what the RNC has said so far, I don't know that we really know how that would work. It certainly would not be like what we saw back in the 40s and 50s. There are no brokers, as in the days of old. Right now, what we'd see is that, as you said, right after the first ballot was inconclusive, it would go to a subsequent vote. And again, it would be up to the delegates to coordinate this, up to the candidates and their campaigns to coordinate this on the floor of the convention. It would be a huge undertaking on their parts and very messy at that.
Well, you know, it makes you wonder, as chaotic and potentially problematic as this would be to take place on television in front of the whole world, maybe this is what the party wants, Josh Putnam. If they can't defeat Trump and Ted Cruz, the two people they want the least, maybe this is the best last-ditch effort.
Well, you know, if Trump is stuck at 30% and is not growing that, then if the field of candidates winnows down to two, then that 30% is a losing share of the vote. That's one way that an establishment candidate could win, or any other candidate for that matter. But sure, you know, the RNC and others, the campaigns themselves are planning on this as a possibility as well, that if things are inconclusive, they've got to plan for this, you know, plan B, essentially.
Plan B, and we should add, it doesn't have to be someone who's been in the race so far, right? Let's fantasize for a minute. Speaker Paul Ryan rides to the rescue to be the nominee on the floor. I don't know. Maybe they reach for Jeb Bush for some other Republican, Nikki Haley, who hasn't been in the race.
Sure. I mean, it can happen. It's difficult to imagine, I think, how that emerges, again, given the way, given the mechanics of this on the floor of the convention, that you're trying to get 1,237 folks on the same page. You've really got to have a near consensus candidate to do that. Paul Ryan may be that. Nikki Haley may be that. It's hard to see Jeb Bush being that with the delegates. But
Josh Putnam, before I let you go, you know, let's just say political conventions have become infomercials. They're awful. I know it's unlikely, but this would be awesome, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be great?
Well, sure. I'd be lying to you if I said it wouldn't be fun. But I'm a rules person. I like to see them work.
Josh Putnam is a rules person, and the rules could, however unlikely, come into play on the floor of the Republican convention if they can't get behind one candidate by then. He's a political science professor at the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia. Josh Putnam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway.
A coalition of groups representing deaf Arizonans has sued the state. It wants Arizona to make sure residents have access to 911 services through texting, as required by federal law. Asim Dietrich is a staff attorney for the Arizona Center for Disability Law, which is one of the groups involved in the lawsuit. Asim, what's the reason for filing?
Well, the reason we filed suit here was that individuals who are deaf and have other speech or communication disabilities currently don't have any direct and immediate access to 911. So the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehab Act of 1973 require that state and local government agencies afford people with disabilities equal access and effective communication to access government services. So without the ability of individuals to send a text to 911, people who are deaf or have other speech disabilities are unable to access 911.
Does the TTY system not work for 911?
The 911 system is required to have TTY available, but TTY has become an obsolete technology. There are very few people who are deaf that actually use TTY. Most individuals who are deaf either text or use a video relay service.
Are there not video relay services available for 911?
There are video relay services, but those services do not provide direct access to 911. An individual who's deaf has to call the relay service, and then the relay service will call 911 and facilitate the conversation. So, and those relay services are also dependent on high-speed internet, which is not always available in emergency circumstances.
So right now in Arizona, if somebody who is deaf or hard of hearing or has other communication challenges has a situation where they need immediate attention, what do they do?
Right now, the only way to access 911 is for them to use their relay service, which, as I said, is not always available due to various issues, including internet an internet connection not being available. So currently, people who are deaf and have other disabilities really don't have any direct and immediate access to 911 services.
Technically, financially, what would it take to implement the texting system?
Well, the FCC requires that the phone service providers provide the ability for individuals to send a text to 911 if the 911 program in a given state or municipality requests it. So really what Arizona would need to do is request from the phone service providers that text 911 be implemented, and then the phone companies would actually implement and install the technology.
So the cost would be borne by the providers, not the state?
Yes, that's correct.
Is this problem unique to Arizona? I mean, are there other states that also do not have a 911 system for folks who are deaf?
We are not the only state without a system, but there are approximately 30 states at this time that provide text to 911 services in at least one or more jurisdictions.
Asim Dietrich is a staff attorney for the Arizona Center for Disability Law, which is one of the groups involved in the lawsuit against the state over the lack of 911 texting services. In a statement, a spokesperson for the Arizona Department of Administration says, quote, "We are in the beginning stages of reviewing the lawsuit and will determine the appropriate course of action in the near future," end quote.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Gordon Stevenson, and I'm the music director and organist at St. Mary's Basilica here in Phoenix. I actually began playing the organ when I was 11 years old. I remember being in the local church and getting a seat close to the organist so we could sit and watch. I wonder if I could do that. Of course, at that time, my feet couldn't even reach the pedals. I was so small. It's certainly something very profound and does leave an impression when you walk out the church. You really feel that you've done something really special.
That's Gordon Stevenson playing the organ at St. Mary's Basilica. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we're a little out of tune, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. This is KJZZ, and in a check of international news, gas prices are pretty reasonable across the U.S., but in the major oil-producing nation of Venezuela, the price of a liter of gas is about to go up a lot. Granted, it was about 1 cent to begin with, and now it'll cost 60 cents.
But it's a sign of the increasingly perilous state of Venezuela's economy that the price has risen at all. For nearly two decades, the government has survived on high social spending supported by oil money, but now there are problems. The BBC's Grace Livingstone has been to some shops to talk with people lined up for basics.
I'm going to the local pharmacy store. Many basic goods in Venezuela are in short supply, so they're regulated by the government. And sure enough, there's a very long queue outside this pharmacy shop. They're waiting all around the car park outside the shop. There's women with children, old men, young men. Let's talk to some of the shoppers.
Quiero comprar lo que me hace falta, shampoo, artículos.
I want shampoo and personal items. I arrived at 5:30 in the morning. I feel very humiliated, very humiliated.
I want nappies, toilet paper, soap. You can't get hold of these things. I've been here since 5 in the morning. It's depressing and stressful. This is the reality. The majority of the country voted for the opposition because we are tired. We want everything to change.
I'm going to take a taxi now to a poorer part of Caracas and speak to some shoppers there. So I've come now to another food shop. It's in a very poor area of Caracas, just on the edge of a shanty town. And I'm standing on a street rising up a steep hill. The buildings are crumbling. There's a tangle of electricity wires poking out of them. Right up the hill here, there is an enormously long queue, perhaps 200, 300 people. So let's talk to some of the shoppers and find out how long they've been waiting.
Bueno, ahorita estoy a las 5 de la mañana.
I've been here since 5 o'clock in the morning. I've been waiting at least 6 hours. I feel very irritated and tired, having to wait in the same queue Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. I think the government's poor administration is to blame.
I want to buy any food that is delivered. Flour, sugar, coffee, milk, oil, soap. I blame this mess on the owners of these big companies which make these products. It's not the government. The government is doing what it can.
I've been a big supporter of this revolution. The government has to realize what it's like for us working people. We're the ones who are suffering because of this. We're here waiting for 10 hours, 12 hours, for 2 kilos of maize flour, for 2 kilos of rice. Those in power have houses full of food, but we're the ones who are paying the price. And then they come and demand that we vote for them.
Voices from the streets of Venezuela, brought to us by the BBC's Grace Livingstone.
Even with expectations for El Niño dropping more rain in the West, the drought's impact is being felt in a deep way in Arizona, California, and Nevada. In a new ProPublica piece called Liquid Assets, reporter Abram Lustgarten focuses on hedge fund manager Disc Dean Jr.'s efforts to commoditize water as a way to lessen waste and increase the price. Abram, does Disc Dean come across as someone who cares about potential water shortages, or is he more focused on making himself a lot of money? Do you think there's a balance point there?
I think his interest in Western water issues is genuine, and his knowledge is certainly genuine. It's an extremely complex set of issues, and there's only a relative minority of the number of people that I've talked to that get it the way he does. And I think his interest in that is genuine in his creative approach. And of course, that both can align with and perhaps risk conflicting with his self-motivated interest that he's in finance. This is an investment opportunity. You need returns for investment opportunities, and ultimately that the goal of that is to make an income, is to make money.
Relatively early in the piece, you have a line that says, "Where government has failed, Dean believes capitalism offers an elegant solution." Can you explain to us what that elegant solution would be?
He believes that if you price water accurately and according to its actual value and demand and scarcity, and you allow it to be traded, that instead of government having to come in and dictate who gets how much water and redistribute or take rights away from one group and give it to another to address the water crisis, that essentially capitalist markets will do that on their own. That when a product, a commodity, becomes expensive, it's used differently. So the people who use it will use it more carefully, will waste it less, will make investments in both the storage of it or the use of it that correspond to its value. And that essentially, if you price water, if you give water more value, that the way it's wasted or the ways in which it's used inefficiently now in the West become very, very expensive. And so the waste decreases.
I've spoken with water experts in the past who have talked about perhaps water becomes the new oil, in essence, where there is a fight over the future of it, who controls it, who owns it. And yet, the argument could certainly be made that we don't need oil. We need water, though, to survive. Do you see a fight like that continuing? And does someone like Disc Dean make a fight like that more or less likely?
I think there's potential for that kind of fight to evolve. But almost unanimously, everyone that I talked to, including Dick Dean, really portrays a worldview that would stop short of getting to that sort of crisis argument. The consensus is that for markets to thrive for water, that you would need some sort of heavy regulation, that it wouldn't be a completely unfettered free market as philosophically pristine as that might be. So Dick Dean would expect regulations to protect the public interest or to set limits on how much could be traded and where. And the environmental groups that I talked to would expect the same. And to the extent that, politicians, and water managers that I talked to support the idea, they also, would see what they call, quote unquote, sideboards for such a market. So basically, like, assurances at a minimal level that there would always be a basic minimum supply of water available to people.
Can you give us an idea of the perception of the people you spoke with about him? Did you pick up a vibe that he is someone who is considered to be someone they can trust, a force to be reckoned with, somewhere in between?
Yeah, certainly somewhere in between. So there was kind of like ranging from a grudging respect to a wholehearted embracement. Came across a couple examples of where his deals had actually rehabilitated farmland that was in a lot of trouble. So in those cases, he's taking a dilapidated property in a rural community and through his short-term investments actually improved that property. And there was a lot of positive viewpoints around that. Certainly met others in government, in some city water agencies, who were much more skeptical, about him personally, about the pitch that he's making.
ProPublica reporter Abram Lustgarten, his new piece is called Liquid Assets.
Arizona is full of historic places. Some are obvious, while others are more off the beaten path. Arizona Highways magazine looks at five of the state's most historic landmarks in its February issue, including Slaughter Ranch near Douglas and the Pioneer Museum in Flagstaff. Noah Austin is the magazine's associate editor. He wrote the Historic Places article and joins me. So, Noah, how do you determine which places to highlight?
I and our my boss, our managing editor, Kelly Vaughn, and then our editor, Robert Steve, kind of, go through sort of the more historic places that exist in Arizona. And it's kind of interesting because I think a lot of people who don't live in Arizona sort of assume, because it's one of the newer states, that maybe there isn't that much history here in terms of like historic structures and things like that. But, as we've found, there are things that maybe don't date back as far as someplace in, say, Pennsylvania or New York or something like that. But the history of the state goes back a lot farther than just statehood. I think a lot of people don't see that side of Arizona, so that's kind of why it's a fun thing to do.
How do you find out about some of these places? Because a couple of them are really, really off the beaten path.
Well, just kind of going through historical records. And, one of the great things about my job is I get to travel around the state and see parts of the state that I probably never would have gotten to otherwise. So you can stumble across things that way. Painted Desert Inn at Petrified Forest National Park, which we featured in the February issue, was one of those where, we do a lot of work with, spotlighting national parks in Arizona, and that's a historical structure that they actually used to put people up there. Now it's mostly operated as a gift shop and visitor center at the park. So that's one way. And then, just the other great thing about Arizona Highways is we have 90 years worth of, well, 91 years now, of magazines to go back and look through and see some of these old buildings and other landmarks that have been featured in the magazine. And then so it's nice to be able to revisit those as well.
Yeah, a few of these, as you referenced the Painted Desert Inn, a place like the Copper Queen Hotel in Bisbee. I think if anybody goes to Bisbee, it's tough to miss that place. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't go in, you see it, you're familiar with it. But then you have a place like the Shumway School in the town of Shumway, which I'm guessing that some of our listeners have probably never even heard of the town. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a place that, you really have to know that it's there to be able to write about it, much less go and visit it.
Right, absolutely. And that was one that was really hard to find anything on just because it's such a small town. It's up in the White Mountains, kind of the Sholo area. And I actually got in touch with Carmen Shumway, who's a member of the Shumway family that founded the town back in the late 1800s. This Mormon settler family that just, they started a town there and they decided they needed not just a building, like sort of a multi-purpose building, not just for school, but for church services and, community meetings and things like that. So everybody just sort of pitched in and built this one-room brick schoolhouse, and they used it for school for 40 years or so, and then kind of fell into disrepair. And then just in the past 15 years or so, they've gotten grants from Arizona State Parks and things like that to rehabilitate it and now give tours. So, you know, that's one for sure that it's nice to be able to direct people to, because, as you said, you're not going to just stumble on that off the highway. So,
do you think that among the places that are in this year's version of this list, is there any sort of unifying theme, or do these places tell us anything about either the state's history or maybe its present?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that there's a unifying theme, but I think they each kind of tell a different story about Arizona. I mean, you mentioned the Copper Queen Hotel. You know, Arizona's history is so deeply rooted in mining, and Bisbee at one time was such a huge copper mining town. You know, for the Copper Queen, I think it really speaks to Arizona's mining history. A place like the Shumway School, it really kind of shows this sort of territorial frontier, can-do, kind of do-it-yourself Arizona spirit that I think is still embodied even in the modern day in Arizona. So I wouldn't say there's a unifying theme, but I would say each of the places kind of embodies an aspect of Arizona that is sort of cherished.
Noah Austin is associate editor for Arizona Highways Magazine. He also wrote the Historic Places article in the February issue of the magazine. Noah, thank you.
Thank you.
Beginning later this month, if you happen to be around downtown Mesa, you may be able to randomly play the piano. It's a project that's been seen across the country before, but this is the first time in Arizona. Public and interactive art are expanding around the valley. To learn more, I'm joined by Gabriela Munoz, Artist Programs Manager for the Arizona Commission on the Arts. Gabriela, how much does public art bring a community together and help other people learn about the character of an area?
Yeah, beyond beautifying our surroundings, which is great, it can really give you a sense of the differing characters of neighborhoods, for example. The installations that are done in Scottsdale with canal conversions are vastly different, for example, than what you can see at the Phoenix Convention Center if you're visiting for conferences. Then, again, if you're just waiting for the light rail, going down to First Friday or Third Friday.
Is this an area that has started to devote more energy, more funding to that kind of thing? And is that a plus?
Phoenix Office of Arts and Culture has done some really great job in investing those dollars in, you know, places like Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport, which is you know, one of the first places that a lot of people see. And so it's really wonderful the way that they've worked with artists to do terrazzo floors and to do installations that are not permanent of artists. And oftentimes, you know, it's just visitors waiting for their next plane, but they're able to see the cultural richness that exists here in Arizona.
How important is it that public art sort of brings about more conversation about certain things?
I think art gets us to ask questions, and that's always a good thing, even if we're not agreeing on what those answers might be. I think, you know, dialogue is a really important part of the art process.
I'm lucky in what I do, you're lucky in what you do, that art is sort of a part of almost every day of our lives in some sense. But a lot of people, they're working a job that has nothing to do with it. And maybe when you're saying waiting for the light rail, you can experience that, or maybe in the course of a 10-hour workday, you don't get a chance to.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being stuck in front of a McDowell and right around Central. And there is a gorgeous piece by an artist named Opie, and it's on the side of Phoenix Art Museum. And you can just sit in traffic and see these two figures walking as you're waiting for the light to change.
What do you think about the interactive piano project in Mesa?
I think Mesa is being really smart because they are spreading them about in different key locations. So it's sort of becoming a musical scavenger hunt, if you will. And it also encourages you to come out more than once and realize that, you know, you can go to the same place and have a different experience every time you come out. And, you know, go check out a piano and play a piano in front of a library. And then go back out and experience a different piece of the series in a different location in a different way.
How about the chance to actually do some stuff with the art and not just observe it?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. And it's a good question, right? Figuring out and training ourselves to realize when is it okay to touch the art and when should we stay away from it and just sort of admire it. And I think public art has a lot of opportunities for interaction. You know, on Sky Harbor, you walk on those terrazzo floors. That's public art. And you're walking right on it. Our time span for viewing something is very, very short. But all of a sudden, when we're able to engage and activate our other senses, then all of a sudden we are spending much more time with a piece of artwork, which is kind of nice.
Gabriela Munoz is Artist Programs Manager for the Arizona Commission on the Arts.
One of the most recognizable voices on public radio will be signing off later this year. Diane Rehm will be leaving her program, but not the public stage. In her new book, On My Own, she describes the death of her husband, John, and the kind of work she'll be doing once she leaves the studio. She's in the Valley today on a book tour, and she joins me. Diane, the book includes a lot of personal details. Why put all of that in print?
Because John and I always dealt with reality. I think too many marriages, you know, look so great in front of the cameras, and behind the scenes, they're terrible. I think too many young people get married today expecting everything to be absolutely perfect. And I wanted to point out that in a very long marriage, a wonderful marriage, in my estimation, that things aren't always perfect. And that is not any reason to part.
Did you find that during the process of writing this book and editing it and now talking about it quite a bit, have you learned anything or realized anything about yourself during that process?
I think you always learn something about yourself in writing. I think the first thing you learn is what you're thinking. When you put it down on paper, you come to realize what you've somehow had in your mind. So you learn about yourself. I think I learned to be more comfortable with the idea of death and dying. I think living with John and then watching him die and being with him has made me more comfortable with the idea of death.
I would think that's in and of itself a very comforting feeling.
It is indeed, and of course I'll be talking about that as I travel around the country and speak about the idea of facing death more realistically without fear as a part of our entire experience.
You're going to be leaving your radio show later this year, and as you say in the book, and as you've discussed elsewhere, you'll be traveling the country talking about various issues. I'm curious, after having done your show for as long as you have, what do you think about it you're going to miss the most? And other than the hour at which you have to get up in the morning, what do you think you'll miss the least?
I think what I will miss the most, number one, the interaction with my wonderful producers every single morning when I walk into the office. I think the thing I shall probably miss the least are the very, very, very few guests who have turned out not to be so great, the people that you wish you had less rather than more time to talk with. But the thing I shall miss the very, very, very least is my own mistake making on the air. When I have done that, it's just, you know, stayed in my mind forever and ever and ever.
Was there ever a thought in your mind that once you stepped away from your daily radio show that you just wanted to relax and kick back and, you know, travel for pleasure, or maybe spend more time with your kids and grandkids and not basically keep up the same kind of schedule that you have been doing?
Guess what? I'm not a kickback kind of person. I tend to be one who likes to be active with friends, with family. Sure, maybe I'll see my kids and grandkids a little more. But, you know, they have busy lives, too. When they invite me, I shall come. But I'm certainly not going to inflict myself on anyone else's life. I have to develop my own new frame of reference, and I'm in the process of doing that as we speak.
Diane Rehm is, of course, the host of The Diane Rehm Show, also the author of On My Own. She'll be speaking tonight at Dobson High School in Mesa. Diane, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.